This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions, a Washington State-based nonprofit seeking to accelerate practical and profitable solutions to global warming. From 1999 to 2002, Casey was a special assistant to the Mayor of Seattle for clean energy and climate protection initiatives. In that capacity, he helped to engineer Seattle City Light's commitment to become the nation's first climate-neutral electric power utility and the city's commitment to exceed the goals of the Kyoto Protocol. Casey Golden is here today to evaluate the effectiveness of our current efforts to meet the threat of climate change. Welcome, Casey.
Thanks, Diane. It's great to be with you.
It's good to have you here. Given our current output of greenhouse gases, how much, according to the best estimates, do we need to reduce our emissions to prevent catastrophic climate disruption?
80% by 2050. We need a wholesale change in what kind of energy we use, how much energy we use. We really need to transform the industrial economy from a fossil fuel economy to a clean energy economy in the next four decades.
How do the efforts to address climate change now compare to what was being done 5 years ago?
It really is remarkable and very heartening to see the progress over the last 5 years. You know, I used to get probably the most frequently asked question I got was, do we really have a problem? I don't get asked that question much anymore. I think we're over that hump. Having said that, we are truly just getting started. When we talk about the effectiveness of the efforts that are being launched now, we are at the very, very beginning of this big, bold, long-term transition. And we have a long, long way to go. But I do have to say that compared to 5 years ago, when it felt like we were really rowing against the wind to get any traction on the issue at all, we now have people basically aligned around the proposition that we have a big challenge on our hands. And people starting to come forward from all sectors, from government, from business, individuals, all over the world and all over the country, to ante up and be part of the global campaign for solutions. But again, we're just right at square one.
What do you consider the most effective steps to be taken right now outside of the transportation sector to address global warming?
Oh, well, I hope we're going to come back to the transportation.
We will come back to transportation.
Right. Particularly for your Northwest listeners and for your Seattle and Washington area listeners, transportation is the lion's share of the issue. The other big sector is electricity and how we use energy, natural gas and electricity in buildings and industries. And I believe that, you know, there's no rocket science here. The fundamentally most important step we have to take is put a limit on the emissions and have that limit over time work its way down to where the scientists say the safe emission levels are. Now, having said that, because it has to be reduced 80% over time, you can't do that just by constraining the adverse effects of the fossil fuel economy. You actually have to build the economy that's going to replace the fossil fuel economy. And on the one hand, that's somewhat more complicated and daunting than just passing an emission limit regulation. On the other hand, it's much more exciting and interesting because it really does give us the opportunity to create a fundamentally new and more sustainable and more secure kind of prosperity than the prosperity that we've built now, which is built on fossil fuels. That's a prosperity that I think we all know can't last for very long and doesn't work for very many people. Now, the transition that we have to make is to a prosperity that can work for a long time for a lot of people. And aside from the transportation part of that, which is big and critical, the building and energy part of it is, first and foremost, use energy more efficiently. We still waste over half of what we consume. So more efficient lights, motors, appliances are available for every application you can think of. We can squeeze more work out of the energy we have now. That's the cheapest and best solution.
And how are we doing in that regard?
You know, we've made really quite a lot of progress in the Northwest, and again, we have a long ways to go. To give you a little sense of the scale, since about 1982, when the nuclear power program in the Northwest collapsed, and we really set our minds to seeing how much energy efficiency we could get, in the four Northwest states, we've saved about 3,000 average megawatts of electricity. And to give you a sense of scale for that, that's more than the whole state of Idaho uses. It's about three times what the city of Seattle uses. And we've done that just by using more efficient lights, motors, appliances, and industrial processes. The cost of that has been less than half the cost of what it would have been to build power plants to serve our old inefficient lights and motors and industrial processes. As Amory Lovins likes to say, it's not a free lunch. It's a lunch you get paid to eat because it's so much cheaper than the alternative of making more energy. So that's an impressive achievement. But we have more than another 3,000 megawatts available to us of cost-effective energy savings, ability to use energy more efficiently that also costs less than the cheapest power from a new power plant. So we've done a great deal, but it's still job one is to keep squeezing more work out of the energy we already use.
What are the barriers there?
One barrier is that electric utilities are the major sort of device that we have for collecting our energy dollars and investing them in future energy resources. Electric utilities, by and large, make money by selling more kilowatt hours, not by saving kilowatt hours. That's not their fault. That's an artifact of the regulatory system, and it's a changeable thing. In some cases, we have changed it, and the results have improved dramatically when we start saying that a utility's profits is not linked to how many kilowatt hours they can jam through the system, but how well they provide us with clean, affordable electric service. So that's a regulatory reform that we can do that really, really improves the prospects. There are other barriers, like for most commercial buildings, the people who pay for the equipment and the people who pay for the glass in the windows and the building systems are often not the people who pay the electricity bill. So even though it would save money over the long haul to install more efficient equipment and build the building better and tighter in the first place, the people who are paying the bills for building the building don't see that economic incentive because they're not the ones who have to pay the energy bill down the line. So disincentives and barriers like that are sort of endemic in the system. You know, you would think if it's a lunch we get paid to eat, why isn't everybody eating it? And yet there it is. There's all kinds of inefficiencies still in the system, all kinds of great opportunities to waste less and live better.
There's been a lot of talk about cap and trade systems as being a good way to go to help reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. What is your view of those? What are the benefits and drawbacks of a cap and trade system?
Well, I think the most important thing is to emphasize that cap and trade starts with cap. The fundamental need is to have a clear and enforceable limit on the amount of this pollution that we're delivering to the atmosphere that ultimately corresponds with what the scientists tell us we have to do. So once you have a cap and once the commitment is there to reduce the emissions in a really legally binding way, then the trade part says, okay, we only have a certain amount of units of carbon that we can put in the atmosphere. Some people have great opportunities to limit or reduce their emissions relatively cheaply. Some people it's harder for. Why don't we give people the opportunity to trade and mix and match as long as we get to that enforceable cap? That's the basic idea of cap and trade, and I think it's fundamentally a good idea. It's not like other pollution sources where when you trade the right to pollute from one place to another, you're imposing pollution on somebody in a new location. Because with carbon dioxide and global warming pollution, it really doesn't matter where you emit it. It doesn't harm local air quality per se. It's, you know, all of the carbon that's emitted everywhere in the world has the exact same effect on the climate. So I think it's a mechanism that can really work. Where you can run into a little trouble is where you try to do the trade without the cap. And then you get money changing hands and you get this sort of market and emission credits, but you don't really, it's hard to tell at the end of the day whether you actually achieved the goal of getting carbon emissions down to a safe level. And that's why cap and trade really has to start with the cap.
How far along is a cap and trade system in the U.S.?
The Northeast states have signed and confirmed a cap and trade agreement for their power system. And I forget the exact start date for that, but that's imminent. There are a number of bills in Congress to have one for the whole country. It's a little hard to say exactly when one of those will pass and go into effect. California and Oregon have both committed to a cap-and-trade kind of approach. Oregon has actually developed one and outlined it. It's not in effect yet. It hasn't been passed into law yet. The West Coast states, and I think that you will very shortly see a commitment from some other Western states to join into an effort to move that policy along in the West Coast states. And all of that action and energy in the states is really going to drive us inevitably toward a national policy, I think.
And how about the cap and trade system in Europe? How well is that working?
It's early. You know, a lot depends on how you do the math at the beginning when you set the cap and you say how many allowances are we going to issue in order to meet that cap. There's a lot of tricky accounting and all of that. And since this is the first time it's been done, the European system definitely had some hiccups. They allocated too many allowances to begin with, and that made the market hit some bumps in the road. So It's early in the game, but I think the cap and trade mechanism has been in effect for many years in the U.S. under the Clean Air Act for other pollutants. And the results have been extraordinarily positive. The cost of reducing these pollutants is much less, by an order of magnitude less, than what they thought it would be because they implemented this mechanism that enabled them to reduce the pollution as cheaply as possible.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions. Our topic is the effectiveness of our current efforts to fight global warming. Let's go on now and talk about the transportation sector that you were emphasizing as particularly important here in the Northwest. What are the most effective steps being taken in this sector to address global warming?
Driving less. You know, from an individual perspective, it really is all about where you live and how car dependent you are. You can sort of divide them up into initiatives that help us reduce car use, initiatives that help us use cleaner cars, and initiatives that help us use cleaner fuels. All three of those are underway in the Northwest. There have been some very effective commute trip reduction programs to help us use less cars. Investment in alternatives to having to use cars is growing, but frankly still not at the level that it might be. It's been stronger, frankly, in Vancouver and Portland, say, than it has been in Seattle to date. Clean cars, we passed a law in the 2005 legislature to join the states that have adopted clean car standards. By no means does that push the envelope technologically, but it means that it sort of brings up the bottom, and it means that all cars delivered to Washington are going to reduce global warming pollution by about 30% relative to existing cars by 2016, and that starts to go into effect in 2009. And then the clean fuels initiatives we passed in the Washington legislature in 2006, a clean fuel standard saying that a minimum percentage of all the gasoline and diesel sold in Washington state needs to come from renewable fuels. That starts out small and can grow over time. So all of those are relatively new, starting out relatively small, and there's certainly a long way to go. I mean, the fundamental issue is, do we build our region to serve cars or to serve people? And the really big ticket items are the transportation infrastructure investments that either make it easier to get around in a car or easier to get around without a car. And those are the kind of big choices that will really drive our emissions from the transportation sector for a long time to come.
How useful is it for individuals, businesses, and other organizations to become carbon neutral by purchasing offsets for their carbon emissions?
Yeah, it's a great question, Diana. It's not a simple question, so let me wind through it a little bit. Carbon offsets can be effective. There is a range of quality in the different carbon offsets that you can get out there on the market. An organization called Clean Air Cool Planet has done a nice guide to the different carbon offset providers. If you just search Clean Air Cool Planet, they have a guide that'll come up. So one issue is just whether the things that you're buying are really effective at reducing global warming pollution. And there's a range of answers from different providers. Some are better than others. Some are very good. But the fundamental issue is that we need to reduce emissions at their source, not just offset them at some other source. Some of those offset programs can work, but remember we talked a little bit earlier about cap and trade, and I said how important it is that we don't get very far along the road toward trade without cap. Offsets are sort of like trade without cap. I'm a believer that once we get a really firm cap on this pollution, we will find interesting ways to mix and match and trade and have some people pay other people to accomplish emission reduction goals in their facilities. Once we're under that cap, we'll know that at the end of the day, after all those trades happened, we really ended up with a better result and less carbon in the atmosphere. With carbon offsets without a cap, it's frankly harder to tell. So I would say that some of the offset programs are worth exploring and worth investing in for an individual. I would not want anyone to get the impression that they are an alternative to actually reducing the emissions that are under your direct control. The fundamental and most important piece of the equation for every business, for every individual, for every country, is to look at the emissions that are within their control and to reduce them by driving less, by using energy efficiency measures, by using renewable energy. In that context, and when we do that, I think offsets can make a useful contribution. I do not think that offsets by themselves or as an alternative to that emission reduction can be a very good climate solution.
What would be an example of an offset that would be good for sure and one that would be a bit more dubious?
A good one for sure is in 2000, Seattle City Light committed to be the first carbon neutral electric utility in the country. And they did it the overwhelming majority of how they did that was with energy efficiency and renewable resources. So they squeezed all the emissions out of their operations that they could figure out how to squeeze. And then they just had a little bit left, and they wanted to get from there to zero. So they were driving trucks around to service utility poles. If you buy power in power markets, inevitably there's a certain amount of carbon in that power. So they said, okay, we want to scrub the last little bit out. We can't do that through our internal operations. Therefore, we're going to purchase some offsets. And one of the things they purchased was they bought down the cost of buying biofuels for Washington State ferries and buses. And as a result, not only did they reduce emissions from ferries and buses, they also provided sort of the anchor market for what is now a very rapidly growing biodiesel industry in Washington. Not a free lunch from an environmental perspective, but much, much better than petroleum. So they actually, by making that commitment and buying those offsets, they helped really build the industries of the future that are going to replace fossil fuels over time. So that's a great example of a good offset. A not so good offset would be if you buy credits from a forest that would have likely been preserved for other reasons, but somebody wants to generate some more income around the carbon that's stored in those trees, then maybe you didn't really change anything. Maybe you just money changed hands, but no more carbon got stored. Or if there's no provision for ensuring that that forest is going to continue to be there in 100 years, if the forest burns down, if there's no control against how that forest is harvested in the future, then the carbon that you stored in those trees was a pretty temporary and not very effective solution. So those are some of the examples.
How helpful has the Kyoto Protocol been so far in helping to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases?
You know, the big problem with Kyoto is that the United States isn't part of it. No global agreement will succeed until the world's largest emitter, the country that bears the largest responsibility for solutions, gets with the program. So Kyoto had a hard time going into effect for many years because the U.S. was standing on the sidelines while the rest of the world was trying to get organized. And it did go into effect, and the rest of the world did move forward with it, in part because they saw that communities like Seattle and places like the West Coast and the Northeast were actively determined to get moving on solutions. And the rest of the world was able at some point to say, all right, well, we don't like your federal government thumbing its nose at us, but we see that many Americans are committed to solutions. And on the basis of that sort of hope and inspiration about what Americans are doing in their communities, Kyoto was able to move forward. It only went into effect in February of 2005. It was negotiated in 1997, but it didn't go into effect until 2005. So it's very early in the life of Kyoto. There is now an active emission trading system and market in Europe. Many countries are doing great work to get to their goals. Not all of them will probably achieve their near-term goals. And frankly, the whole system won't gel until the U.S. comes to the party.
How does the U.S. currently stand on climate change at the federal level?
There is some very interesting and accelerated activity in Congress to get this country moving toward a climate policy. So the prospects are much improved. But the status quo is appalling. It is appalling that the United States has no meaningful climate policy and has expressed no willingness so far to join with the rest of the world to solve this problem. I don't know any other way to sugarcoat it. You know, it really is an international scandal that the U.S. has so far been unwilling to join the rest of the world on this. And I can tell you that the rest of the world is not the least bit amused. This is one, maybe among many, but certainly one problem where it's very clear that America and Americans bear the lion's share of the responsibility for coming up with solutions. We are the ones who paved the way to prosperity using fossil fuels. It's not surprising that the rest of the world wants to follow that path to prosperity. We can't very well pull up the drawbridge on China and India and everybody else who wants to be prosperous. They don't aspire to be huge emitters. They aspire to have a prosperous lifestyle. And the only way to prosperity that has been pioneered so far is the U.S. way, and that's using a lot of fossil fuels. We have to pioneer a new path to prosperity and get with the rest of the world to really start moving on solutions.
Could you comment on the bills that are currently before Congress and which ones are likely to be most effective in helping to prevent global warming?
There's almost every day there's a new answer to that question, and which reflects a lot of good energy and I think goodwill and willingness on the part of Congress to get moving sooner rather than later. It's instructive that many of the major presidential candidates from both parties have signed on to relatively strong climate bills in Washington. I would say the strongest and the best is the Boxer-Sanders bill, which would get us moving toward the scientifically necessary goal of reducing emissions by 80% by 2050 and has good interim targets and timelines and good enforceable mechanisms for making sure we get there. Another leading bill was originally introduced by Senators McCain and Lieberman and has since been co-sponsored by Senators Clinton and Obama. So it is the sort of the prospective president's climate bill. It also has fairly good initial steps on reducing global warming pollution. It has the problem of having nuclear incentives in it as well, which makes it sort of unnecessarily controversial. You know, everybody's got their own preferred solution, including the nuclear industry. I think we're going to be better off, frankly, if we have a climate policy that's just a climate policy and then have other policy discussions about which solutions are better in other bills. But those are two of the leading contenders. Senator Bingaman has had a bill that was relatively weak. I'm told that that bill is going to be getting stronger. But the things to look out for, and I think the things to insist on, are follow the science. We got to go where the science says we got to go to avoid catastrophic climate disruption. And the science is so solid on that now that there's really no excuse for going any other direction. And clear, enforceable caps on global warming pollution without any off-ramps from meeting those targets. And the reason I say that is obviously because of the environmental imperative, we need to have that certainty. But it's also true that, remember, we're not just trying to constrain the fossil fuel economy, right? We're trying to build a new sustainable prosperity with new energy sources. If you don't have really strong binding legal caps, you don't send the message to entrepreneurs and investors and the financial markets that we're really serious about making this transition. They need that strong, serious message from our policymakers so they can go to the bank and begin to get the financing for the kinds of technologies and enterprises and policies and practices that are going to really help us accelerate this transition. So I think the obligation of Congress and our policymakers is to have a policy commitment that is genuinely, unmistakably legally enforceable so that the people who are going to build the clean energy economy of the future, in effect, have a contract from the people, a contract from our policymakers, that we're serious about this and the people who invest in solutions are going to be the winners in the future.
What most stands in the way of having these mandatory caps?
Oh, you know, there's a certain amount of it is inertia. We've just been fighting this sort of unproductive battle about whether we really have a problem for so long. I think that there is a cultural obstacle that, you know, in our political culture, there's a sense that freedom is a big part of the American culture ever since, right, the Boston Tea Party and before. And anything mandatory sounds like it's a constraint on freedom. And so I think you see that kind of political philosophical barrier in the way. I think we need to get past that quickly. You know, the people who object to government mandates, I think, are thinking of restrictions on personal freedom and that sort of thing. This is a case where making it mandatory is simply a way of saying the people are serious about accomplishing this objective. And the people are serious enough that we're willing to have a policy that is strong enough and enforceable enough that we can build a new economy around it. And that's why we need a mandatory policy like this. I would also say, apart from the philosophical objections, there's a lot of the fossil fuel industries and the automobile industries collectively are the largest commercial enterprise in human history, and they have a lot of political power, not surprisingly. And that goes beyond political party. They don't have only power with one party. They have deep power in Washington. The hopeful sign is that I think those industries are beginning to shake out, and you're beginning to see some separation of the folks who want to dig in their heels and just prolong fossil fuel dependence as long as possible. That's their business strategy. And the people who are starting to see the writing on the wall and the necessity for this transition are starting to position themselves to be the winners in that transition. And so I don't think that the fossil fuel industries or the automobile industry are monolithic on this anymore. I think you're starting to see that some of them are coming forward, including GE and BP and DuPont and others, saying that we absolutely need a mandatory policy in order to have clear rules of the road and clear signals for what kind of investments are going to be profitable in the future.
What kind of relative role do you see for public participation as opposed to public policy in terms of addressing climate change?
Yeah. Well, let me sort of break that down into three ways that people can be involved. One is I'd call get it. be aware and engaged. There's 24 people now in Washington State who have been trained to show Al Gore's slideshow. They would love to come there, show their slideshow at your church group, at your neighborhood association, at your PTSA. Get that information. Understand the science. Understand the solutions. There's so much great information out there. The UW Climate Impacts Group is a terrific science resource. Climate Solutions and others are terrific solution resources. So continue to inform yourself. Continue to talk about it. Don't make it, sometimes it feels big and scary and remote, and so people sort of make it taboo because why talk about something that's so big and remote? Part of it is just getting it, talking about it, being conversant in it. So get it, number one. Number two, do it. Be part of the solution in whatever scale is appropriate for your life, your business, your home. Use clean energy. Use transportation alternatives. Become more efficient in your own energy use. If you were doing that alone, if I was saying go and screw in a light bulb to solve global warming, and that was an isolated consumer action, you would probably be skeptical about how effective that would be. And what I would say to that skepticism is you are not alone. People all over the world are mobilizing for solutions. Everybody can and must be part of the solution. See your individual contribution in the context of a growing groundswell of our whole generation across the world to solve this problem. Everybody's got to be part of that groundswell. So get it, do it. And then number three is change it. When you said, what can you do kind of personally as opposed to policy? I would say not as opposed to. I would say policy is personal. Who you vote for, what you demand of your elected leaders. You know, we've kind of set our expectations too low, I think, of what government is supposed to deliver, what elected leaders are supposed to deliver. Set that bar higher. We should expect more of our public officials. We should vote for people who are committed to solutions. And we should get actively engaged in the policy process. It's very easy, and we can do that if you come to climatesolutions.org, and other organizations can do it too, to plug you directly into the kind of climate policy battles that when I leave this studio, I'll be going down to fight in Olympia. This is very live, and direct citizen engagement is the most effective and important thing in moving our policymakers to better solutions. So get it, do it, and change it.
What role do you see climate change playing in the 2008 presidential campaign?
I think it'll be a big issue, and I think it'll be rolled together with, you know, climate change is a function of fossil fuel dependence. Fossil fuel dependence is not only our greatest environmental challenge because of climate change, it is arguably our greatest national security challenge because it gets us entangled all over the world to protect our oil and energy interests. And it's also one of our greatest economic challenges. In Washington State right now, $30 million leaves our economy every single day to pay for oil and gas. That is more than we spend on K-12 education. So when you ask how will climate change play in the next election, I think climate change as part of this larger issue of fossil fuel dependence and how it affects our national security and our economy, those three things together, I think, will be a defining feature of the next election.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
On the cover of Time magazine in April of last year, they said, be very worried. I would like to give you an alternative response. I think we should be very hopeful. I think we should be very urgently committed to solutions. I think we should be very impatient with the pace at which our elected leaders are rising to this challenge. I think we should be very determined to make this our generation's defining challenge, our defining opportunity to create a sustainable future for our kids. This is our opportunity to write our autobiography. You know, you'd like to say you can write your story any way you want, but future generations are only going to remember us for how we handled a relatively few challenges, and this is certainly one of them. This is an opportunity to write a story about who we are and what we did on this earth that our descendants will tell with pride and gratitude. And the alternative story, the story about what they're going to say about us if we fail to rise to this challenge, is frankly not a story I want to leave my kids with. So that's the message. This is our big challenge. This is our big opportunity, and it's time to grab it by the horns.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Casey.
Thank you, Diane. I really appreciate it.
We have just been speaking with Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions. For more information, check on the web at www.climatesolutions.org. Again, that's climatesolutions.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week.